This is Macro Analytics, delivering frank conversations on global macroeconomics and market analysis outside the mainstream, featuring discussions and debates between Gordon T. Long, publisher and editor of GordonTLong.com, and his guests. The content of this discussion is strictly the opinion of the participants. It is in no way a solicitation for business, nor is it to be considered investment advice of any sort. Always consult a registered investment advisor before making any investment decision. These discussions are extremely hard-hitting and terribly frank, and parental discretion is advised. Now, on to the show.
Good morning. I'm Gord Long with GordonTLong.com. I have Paul Brodsky joining us this morning from New York. Paul is a very well-respected investment strategist. Paul spent several decades trading bonds and other securities for such Wall Street companies as Drexel, Burnham, Lambert, Kidder Peabody, Spyglass Capital, where he actively managed mortgage-backed derivative funds for over a decade. Simply said, Paul understands Wall Street thinking and maybe more importantly, the game of capital allocation. Welcome, Paul.
Nice to be here, Gord.
Paul, it is an honor to have you and joining us. I need to tell our listeners a story that you recently introduced, at least I read this, I wasn't there, that you introduced yourself to 100 of the world's leading money managers at a presentation at the Park Plaza in New York, and you started it by saying, I'm Paul Brodsky, I'm a gold bug. And that, frankly, not only takes guts, but maybe more importantly and significantly, credibility. You must have some serious credibility, Paul.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know if anyone that ties themselves with gold can have any credibility. And actually, it was 200 of the world's largest institutional investors, from large sovereign wealth funds and pension funds, endowments, foundations. And they were in the audience at the plaza looking at this oddity that went to the podium that was chosen. I was probably the sixth or seventh one they asked, I assume, to represent the case for gold.
They asked for that.
They asked because
that is shocking in itself.
Well, it was 2010, and gold had a bit of a run, and so it was the elephant in the room probably for 9 years prior to that. And I think they felt they needed some representation, so they gave me 20 or 25 minutes. And I did go to the podium, and having mingled with a crowd beforehand, I knew that this was not necessarily hostile. Everyone was very, very jovial and happy and eager to hear all about emerging markets at the time. But here I was supposed to represent the case for gold. So I went to the podium and said, hi, like I was at an AA meeting. Hi, I'm Paul Brodsky, and I'm a gold bug. And there was laughter, thankfully. And the crowd was very warm. I don't know if I said gold the rest of the time. The entire 20 minutes, I just made my case, talked about the monetary system, the global monetary system. And I think that said it all. And so I was very warmly received afterwards as well, and opened a few eyes, I think.
Having been to many of those kinds of presentations, that was a smart thing to do, because no matter what you said, they weren't putting gold in their allocation. They just weren't going to do it. But maybe times will change, and I'm not trying to be a gold bug here either. It's just the fact of life of the world that we live in. Maybe, Paul, we can start with you just giving our listeners a little bit more overview of your background, this new endeavor you have that's called Macro Allocations, and what prompted you actually to use that as an introduction?
Well, the introduction, the bio you gave of me leading into this, went through my life as a bond trader on Wall Street, and then within a hedge fund I founded for 10 years. After that, I co-founded with my partner Lee Quaintance, QB Asset Management. And we would put out a lot of macro, because we were a macro fund. We'd put out a lot of macro letters, investor letters, and they caught on. and they were passed around from our investors, to all sorts of institutional investors and fiduciaries and consultants and whatnot. So we got more and more ambitious in what we would share, or willing, I should say, in what we would share with our investors and with non-investors that were just interested in our letters. Where our ambition came in was in seeking the truth about what drove markets, what was the driver of value, which is not necessarily the driver of price, as you well know.
There is a difference.
There's a huge difference between value and price, and it's immature to think that they're one and the same. We've all been there in early in our careers, but if the goal was to make money or provide alpha risk, excess returns, to take good risk-adjusted positions, we want to know more, and that's where our ambition came in. And so we shared that struggle, and it is a struggle. We shared that with our investors and with others that, for one reason or another, couldn't invest in a hedge fund and couldn't invest in our fund. They just weren't set up by mandate or any other way. But we opened it up and didn't charge anything for it and developed quite a following. So as one will do, we morphed, and I morphed, from bond trader, very comfortable with rate structures and currencies and watching the Fed, having watched the Fed for 25 years at the time, into what is the driver of value across markets. And so we were investing across markets. And I guess that's how macro investors become macro investors. They have to come from someplace. We came from the bond markets. And we ended up rolling QB into a larger organization, with a fellow named Dave Iben, who we were friendly with, and he runs now Copernic Global Investors. I just left in April to finally do what I've wanted to do for years and years and years. With his blessing, we're on very amicable terms. As a matter of fact, he was one of our first subscribers to MAI. And I opened Macro Allocation Inc., or MAI. And what this is, it's taking all the macro stuff we look at, we read about, and we drop it down ultimately into model portfolios. We're going to launch this fall. We've just come out with a preliminary website that's taking subscriptions, but that's not why I'm here.
I have the website up now, just so people are aware of it, Paul.
That's very kind. We're going to take a few pre-launch founding memberships. It's been a month, and it's beautifully on track, and we're very pleased with the way it's going. So that's where we are. It's there are no limits to geographies, to asset classes, to what we're going to review. We're going to provide a lot of information and ultimately drop it down into something that I think is pretty actionable. So,
well, at Financial Repression, we have really come to the conclusion that internationalization, proper diversification under the context of internationalization, truly understanding macro trends is critical to your survival going forward, and especially with the amount of geopolitical, sovereign kinds of policies, monetary policies that are going on. And you should be able, your group, people you bring in to really bring that to bear. Paul, we're here to discuss this morning Financial Repression. And with your background and your experience, what does it mean to you? how do you define it in your own mind? And frankly, is it a policy, or is this, or is the Fed just making this up as it goes?
I think there's a little of all of that that is going on. I think there, it's easy to think that there's a grand conspiracy out there in terms of policymakers and the banking system and politicians and the political dimension. And it's very easy to draw lines between all these groups, connecting them. I think that what we have is a natural set of incentives that are drawn together by how the system works. So, for example, politicians generally like to spend money that they don't have, and that's not a judgment call here. I'm just, that's
fact,
evidentiary. And banking systems can let them do that. So it's a very symbiotic relationship. One feeds the other. There doesn't have, there no need for that a word be said between the two. There's no, I don't think, major backroom smoke filled back rooms where they're.
I don't think they're that clever and that well organized personally, but it is part of like John Adams' invisible hand, a little different than he defined it. It's just a natural incentive that's carrying us in a direction, it seems to me.
I think I would agree with that, Gord. I mean, and what we have is we have had, obviously, I'm sure your viewers are very familiar that in 1971, after the Nixon shock, we, for the first time maybe ever, had a global monetary system where there wasn't one currency that was hard, backed by anything scarce. And what that did was create a, it made everything relative. It made currencies relative. It made financial assets relative. Ultimately, it made performance relative. And when everything's relative, it becomes very easy for authorities to manage the system because there's really no there's no governor on them to bring things back into balance. So what was once the quip where the role of the Fed is to take the punch bowl away when the party starts to go, you know, they were spiking the punch bowl. Everyone's heard that before, but
they've become the bootlegger.
Yeah,
what's going on? You know, and when you said 1970, when we went off the gold standard, and this is not about gold, when we went off a forced discipline, all of a sudden behavior can change. There's no restrictions, as you say, it's on something that's has some restriction on it, that's rare, it's limited in scope. Irrelevant of whether it's gold, something that puts a stake or a foundation in the ground, sound money. Is that a fair
summary? I think that's exactly right. I would go even further and say the system as it's constructed, and I'm talking about fractional reserve lending, fractionally reserved banking, that's the real bugaboo.
Yeah.
And there's two sides to that. I mean, hard money advocates tend to despise fractional reserve banking and baseless currency, and you know I'm on board with that. There was an upside to all that in the past, to that undisciplined way of promoting credit that. And debt that never had to be repaid and so on and so forth. We're just getting into that now, the consequences of that now. On the other side of the coin, who's to say it didn't help the United States and its allies bankrupt communism because we could spend much more with fake money than the Russians who
Well, that was part of the strategy was to force them into a competitive arms race that we could win financially.
We could win because it was all credit.
Right. That's what I meant financially.
Much of it, yeah. And innovation, you know, much of this stuff, and we make fun of the dot-com bubble, but if it wasn't all silly money, It may not have laid cable that became so important to our communications infrastructure, things like that. So it's been a terrible, terrible flowering of baseless credit, debt that has never been extinguished. It may all come down in a Minsky-like debt deflation that is ugly, or it may force the Fed and other central banks around the world to create much more base money through quantitative easing and other lines of credit and various other operations that diminishes the value of all our currencies, not just dollars, but euro, yen, renminbi, all of them together. And that's getting back again to relative value and relative performance, because we've all been, I think, when I say we, it's all central banks and the currencies that they oversee. They've been devaluing versus each other on a kind of a tag team way, but more importantly, against production. The value of production, it used to be that there was only one way to get a dollar. Well, say four ways. You could produce something and get money in return. You could borrow it. You could take what you already earned and reinvest that and get some more, or you could steal it. Now, banking systems or banks can make money from thin air without any, as you say, without any discipline on the other side, and it becomes debt. It's created through the loan process, and it never has to be extinguished if monetary authorities don't demand that. So, long way of saying, yeah, I think it's a big, we've gone through this great leveraging over the last 35 years. It's been encouraged by monetary authorities in the United States and elsewhere. Now that we're at zero interest rates, we can't refinance our way to another round of leveraging. We have to find a new outlet for credit, or there's going to be some type of reconciliation. So when you ask about financial repression, I think it's been forced on monetary authorities. It's their own doing. It had to happen. It's a consequence of the past 35 years.
But they're reacting to past policies.
I think
with little option in their mind.
That I don't. I think they're boxed. I think monetary authorities are boxed. That's the major central banks, and the IMF and everyone else involved. I don't know that, and this is a bit tangential. I don't know if there's anyone that will stand up as a counter to mostly Western, of course, I include the Bank of Japan in this as well, but mostly Western monetary authorities to say, no, you can't do that. If you look at China or Russia even, it's in their best interests as well to have a fiat monetary system, to have a baseless currency, and to even have fractionally reserved banks. What it does is it centralizes power to decide what wealth looks like in their nations, in their economies. So my sense is that we've got to accept that this is the reality, that there is, for the first time maybe ever, and that's always a dangerous phrase, but the first time ever. But certainly we've never seen zero interest rates before. So that's the first. And now I think that's a symbol of what I'm talking about. But I think there's going to be increasing coordination amongst all sorts of monetary authorities and the net loser is going to be the saver or the pensioner in real terms. It's not necessarily a negative call on equities or real estate or anything that relies on credit to have a bid and to keep its value, its price, excuse me. But I think, and as a matter of fact, it may be somewhat bullish on nominal pricing, bearish on real pricing, and you know, in value, but generally bullish on nominal pricing. That's what financial repression is bringing us.
We have it's bringing us in talking to so many people, so many things, but one of them is changing the capitalist system, whether probably is an unintended consequence. You know, the capitalist system is about capital being invested in income-producing productive assets that's going to create wealth or savings. So savings are reinvested. It seems to me that we've moved away from that and we're creating credit, and credit for the sake of consumption in a 70% consumption economy. And that's taken over. So the top line growth, last quarter, 90% of the S&P went back into buybacks and dividends. Top line growth is just not there. And with quantitative easing, and I'm a layman, so the professional, correct me. But quantitative easing is created is lots of debt. Debt is future demand brought forward. We're getting marginal increases in demand, matter of fact, a concern. But the bigger issue is we've created production or supply of monumental proportions in the emerging markets, whether it's production in China, whether it's raw materials in Indonesia. And now we have supply so out of touch with demand, it's creating pricing pressures. And pricing pressures mean a form of deflation because you start having to be competitive, because cheap money means anybody can produce. What's wrong with that statement I just made, Paul?
I think it's absolutely spot on. I think what we've had was a slow migration from capital-producing economies to, as you say, credit-producing economies. You could say from capitalism to financialism.
Yes, exactly.
Which is really what we've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
One of the benefits I alluded to before about that process, because you know there's two sides to everything. One of the benefits of that was that it did bring along Russia out of communism and China out of communism, and it allowed them to transition in a way that wasn't terribly militaristic. And they did it smoothly into somewhat of a quote-unquote capitalist society. China exported deflation to us in term for consumers, as you suggest, by producing cheaper than even Japan at the time, if you remember, and Korea.
Oh, yeah.
Now they're having wage pressures. Generally speaking, we have a great global capacity, overcapacity, production overcapacity, as you suggest. That's driving the general price level, prices lower, and that's natural, and that should be a good thing, ordinarily.
It should be.
It should be. Economies are supposed to economize.
But not when you got excess debt.
But you can't with excess debt. And that's the bugaboo that central banks face. They have to try to inflate a naturally deflating global economy. That's why they have to coordinate policy, which they do at every other month in Basel, Switzerland, and why they have to make sure that that we don't have major debt deflation, because that's ruinous. That's what we had in the 30s. They can do it on paper. They can print a lot of money. What they've printed so far, there's been a lot written on this, and we've done a lot of work on this, but what they've printed so far are bank reserves. They basically create new money to buy debt through the banking system, and they pay the banks. They use the new money to pay the banks. That becomes bank reserves. And they take the debt onto their balance sheets. Meaning
so we have $2 trillion of excess bank reserves sitting over at the Fed right now, do we not?
I think it might be more than that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'd hate myself.
I think it might be twice that at this point. But yeah, I mean,
why?
But it used to be, and I take what you're saying. You're saying it very tongue in cheek. We have supposedly anywhere from two to trillions of dollars, let's say, in excess reserves. However. They're reserving about $20 trillion in bank assets.
Yeah.
So you can say $2 or $3 or $4 trillion in excess reserves are excess because you're supposed to have zero reserves, which is what we used to have before 2008.
In a working economy, that's usually what, because everybody wants to maximize profits. That's usually
right.
what you have.
Right.
But obviously, concerned, afraid, as I watch money velocity continue to plummet, it says they have some concerns somewhere, do they not?
I think they have terrible concerns. I think they're being more creative than economists are supposed to be. Right.
Yes. And is there concern, Paul, collateral that there could be a devaluation in bonds, that is a falling in bond prices or equity prices or, even real estate prices, the collateral could start to slip. And we have pyramided collateral with rehypothecation, collateral transformation. I mean, all sorts of games, if you would, and maybe that's an exaggeration, that's put them in a position where they're nervous with counterparty risks.
I think collateral is the name of the game.
Yes,
I think we are in a balance sheet quandary, which might be a balance sheet recession, which is the biggest fear of authorities. It means basically that it's not about flow anymore. It's not about whether there's ongoing profits or revenue growth or output growth, GDP, but it's about, the collateral that is backing all the credit is starting to get weak. Do we mark it down? How do we mark it down? Is it going to mean asset seizures? Is it going to mean we have to mark down the prices, the values of bank collateral, of bank assets, if the stock market or real estate prices or bond prices go down? Everything, financial assets, have become collateral, I think.
Yeah,
First and foremost,
bonds have become assets, not debt.
Bonds are, well, debt, this is interesting, credit is and debt are mirror images, right? So when a bank creates a loan from thin air, it is an asset. That's bank accounting. So debt is our obligations and their assets, and it depends which way you're looking at it.
Until it changes in value and it's securing loans. In other words, until if interest rates were to move up, or even if volatility was to increase, or liquidity was to get more difficult, because out of Basel III, Dodd-Frank, the banks aren't working as market makers anymore. They're more or less working as agents, finding buyer, Volcker rule. They're out of the prop desk. I mean, so suddenly there's a shortage, not intentionally, of liquidity in a $100 trillion market.
Right. Yeah, I think there's a little gamesmanship going on as well. There could be more liquidity if probably banks didn't feel, U.S. banks didn't feel pressured to not use as much of their balance sheet as they have been.
Why is that? Why is they feel that they shouldn't or they can't?
Well, I think banks would like to not have any limitations on their on the use of their balance sheet.
Of
And I
course.
think Dodd-Frank went or is trying to get them to have higher capital ratios.
That's the intent.
So, as Jamie Dimon says, it makes us less competitive than other global banks if we have to compete with more capital. And he's right about that. But meanwhile, if that means that they are not going to make markets the way they used to, then it does add to illiquidity. It lessens liquidity in the capital markets.
Are you seeing that? Do you believe that that's what's happening right now, or am I exaggerating my comment?
Most likely. Yeah, I mean, I think volume is way down in terms of not in terms of the amount traded, but in terms of who's trading it. We know that participants have backed away. There's large pools of capital doing all the volume. There's both in stocks and bonds. Foreign exchange is by far the largest market now, way more so than stocks and bonds trading,
I think 5 trillion,
multiples.
almost 5 trillion a day, is
That's
the numbers
right.
I see.
That's right.
It's
So
magnet. But remember too, Paul, in my mind, it's four currencies. It's the pound, it's the sterling, it's the yen, and it's the dollar. That's 95% of the global currencies. Who are the currencies being most debased right now? Those four. It's not the yuan, not the ruble, it's not the real. Who are on the end of the currency wars right now in many ways, and also, by the way, happen to be the ones buying gold. Interestingly enough, I don't know why that is.
well, their currencies aren't as widely held.
They're not liquid. I mean, they're just
And
not as liquid.
so from the standpoint of the dollar has been the largest reserve currency. It's still about 62 or so percent of reserves, which to your
But
audience,
down from about north of 70%
that's
lately.
right. That's right.
And with going to the petrol yuan, I think they just called it last week out of China and Russia. There's less dollars slowly but surely being required out there that eventually will come home as IOUs, will they not?
I think certainly the dollar is becoming less of a reserve currency, but I don't think it's going to fail as a reserve currency.
No, I don't even suggest that.
I
It's not
think
yet.
it's, I think we're going to have I don't know about multiple reserve currencies, and for your audience, this is if a Japanese business sells cars to South America, they still exchange the cars for dollars. They don't do it for riyal or anything like that. And that is what a reserve currency is, as I'm sure most know from your work. Most still feel comfortable with dollars. There's no question about it. It might be, and it's King Dollar. Since 1971, it has been the gold of the currency, of global currencies. So
It's kind of like the least ugly at the party. Is that the right way of describing it right now? It's the one you can feel the most comfortable with, even though you're worried about it.
I think that's fair. It's not a hard currency that can hold its value in a major inflation or a major deleveraging. We know that, and we but I think beyond certain smaller currencies, it's certainly a very strong currency, and it should be. We have deep markets, the rule of law. We're the largest economy, largest trader. So there's good reasons why it should be a reserve currency, and certainly, you can't name a currency that should replace it, a fiat currency that should replace it. So I
Eventually,
think it's
maybe, but
going to,
not today.
you know, I think the renminbi will certainly challenge it and succeed to a certain degree. Whether or not they back the renminbi with gold, whether or not, for whatever reason, they're a large trader, they're certainly trying to grow their markets, as we've seen very recently. And I think they're very good diplomatically, and they're very hard negotiators. And certainly, they're taking their dollar reserves now and spreading them all around the world, and increasing their soft power, which is something that the U.S. has always been brilliant at. So they seem to be quick studies. And they have a new mercantilism. Theirs is more public than private than the West has been. But I think they're succeeding. And it's not necessarily something that those of us in the West should be frightened about. I think it's just going to, that's what's going to keep us honest. That's what's going to actually, in my view, drive prices to where they, to closer to where they should be. That's going to be the competition. But I think it will be ultimately worked out diplomatically.
Paul, something I just have to ask you, and somebody who rode with them, and I will refer to them as Baden vigilantes, where did they go? Where are they with $200 trillion in debt that can't be quantified as riskless? We have a lack of price discovery. I happen to believe a mispricing of risk right now. And usually the bond vigilantes brought us to bear. Hmm. What's changed?
So I remember in the early 80s, as a bond trader, they used to release the monetary aggregates. This was when Paul Volcker was chairman of the Fed.
Do you mean like M3?
Disappeared in March of 06. I remember it
disappeared.
It well.
Yes, exactly.
Because it cost them $40,000 to publish. But in the early 80s, they used to release the monetary M1, M2, M3 on Friday afternoons.
And the world would stop.
It was
bigger
terrible.
Than the labor number.
Well, you know, I was a young kid going to Newport at the time, and I used to hate it because we couldn't leave until after the stupid Fed release, you know, the reports. Thankfully, they changed it to Thursday so we could get out on summer weekends. But it's always been that way. You know, the bond vigilantes, which we were, got trampled.
Is that what happened?
I think the Fed in particular has maintained easy credit conditions for the better part. Even when they raise interest rates, it's not necessarily tightening. If you keep a steep enough yield curve. That doesn't diminish credit too much.
If you have a trend channel over a long period, that's a yield steadily going down within a tight regression, which I can show, it's tough to fight that.
Yeah, and the more we levered up our balance sheets, both public and private, the more it became obvious that you can't have a recession. You can't have a long period where asset values go down, because then it creates this whole balance sheet solvency issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's very difficult to be a bond vigilante and say, well, you know, you need to take the punch bowl away, because once you're levered, you take the punch bowl away, all heck breaks loose. You can't do it.
Paul, any comments you can make on why we have a $555 trillion swaps marketplace out there on a global economy of maybe $72 trillion? Why does that trouble so many people? Does it trouble you?
Yes. You're supposed to net it out.
Yes.
Which is what major swaps dealers tell us. I don't have the confidence enough that swap books, you know, if Deutsche Bank has $75 trillion and J.P. Morgan has $70 trillion on their books.
Those are pretty close numbers, actually.
Whether it's spread out really among 8 or 9 large money center banks, whether they and their central banks are going to be able to do it, if need be, when the time comes, are going to be able to net it out. What I think you can take from that is that they do have a vulnerability that goes beyond everything on their balance sheets, because these swap books are not on their balance sheets. And they do have a political weakness as a result of that. And they do have to follow the they can't completely ignore the political dimension where they're housed, where they're domiciled, because it could get ugly. So it does bother me. It should bother me. It should bother everybody. Whether or not it creates this cascading event that affects the real economy, I'm not so sure. Mm-hmm. The reality is, a bank is just a vehicle, and it does have buildings and people and branches and balance sheets, but it's supported by another vehicle, which is a central bank that can just create the money from thin air, create the reserves to back them. If you reduce the value, the 500 trillion or whatever it is, in swap books, in derivatives, to zero tomorrow, or if you just wrote it off, I think the only thing that would change would be the exposures that banks then have, commodity changes and things of that nature. If you just netted it all out, if you collapsed the market entirely, you would have claims among the various banks. Deutsche Bank may say to JP Morgan, oh, you owe us this amount of money, but it's just, you know, between them and the other counterparties that may be peripheral to their swap agreements. But they're all big boys. Whether or not their balance sheets can take it, I don't know. But if they couldn't take it, then it would be easy for all the employees of JP Morgan to not even cross the street, but to just put another sign up there that says, okay, now we're called Morgan JP, and we're a new entity, and we no longer have the swap books. So I don't see it as really impacting the real economy.
Interesting insight on that. I really appreciate you sharing that. Paul, we're up against our hard line. It's a great discussion. I'm really enjoying it, but we have to halt here. Could you tell our listeners how they could learn more about what you're doing with macro allocation, the plans there, and some of your writings and the things you're involved with today?
Well, as I said, we're going to launch in the fall, probably mid-October. Right now, we're taking pre-launch founding memberships, as we're calling them. They can go to our preliminary website at macro-allocation.com and check it out and take a look what we're doing. We're going to reviewing, analyzing the macro world, all geographies, markets, and trying to drill down methodically to get to risk-adjusted model portfolios, and then publishing those portfolios and tracking them. That's in part from my background as a portfolio manager and analyst that I feel is something that might be interesting to some people out there, mostly to professional investors and investment advisors and financial advisors and institutional investors and sophisticated straight individual investors as well.
Paul, thank you very much for the time. As I said, I enjoyed it. I've got to have you back again because I enjoy your insights, and I know we're going to have a lot to talk about this year and next year. It's going to be interesting times, as it always is in these markets.
It's been fun for me too, Gordon. Thanks very much.
Have a good weekend. Talk to you.
You too.
Bye-bye.
This has been Gordon T. Long, editor and publisher of GordonTLong.com. New recordings are posted regularly and can be found at GordonTLong.com. New show notifications are available through RSS feed, iTunes, and other social networking venues at GordonTLong.com.